Today we have 165 affiliate groups around the world as part of the global network, and we are working to stop the nuclearization and weaponization of space. I think by now most people are beginning to realize that this war today going on in Iraq is a space war. We know that the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office, one of the secret agencies of the Pentagon, has been identifying for some time Iraqi targets. And in the opening salvos of that war, the United States had the capability to essentially reduce Iraq's military capability to almost zero within hours. The NRO insignia says, "We own the night." There's another agency inside the Pentagon that's become a little bit well-known recently, the Information Awareness Office. John Poindexter, the former Iran-Contra figure. You notice their logo here. After this recent hullabaloo about the Information Awareness Office, the folks there, Poindexter and his people, took this logo off their website, because they were a bit embarrassed by this all-seeing eye. The whole purpose of the Information Awareness Office is to intercept communications and information about American citizens, ostensibly to protect us from terrorism, but it really is about spying on the American people. They say that the Persian Gulf War back in the early 90s was actually the first space war ever. With U.S. satellite capability, we pre-identified all of Saddam Hussein's military targets before that war even began, just like this time. And in the first 2 days of that war, we bombed over 95% of Saddam Hussein's military capability, leaving in place intentionally 5%, a tiny sliver of capability that we then played cat and mouse with during the remaining weeks of that war, where we used 100 cruise missiles at $1 million apiece, tested out new stealth bombers and new laser weapons. And at that time, a guy by the name of Charles Horner was commander of the Space Command, and he said, "We came out of the war deeply sensitized to the value of space. Future military success," they said, "will depend on space capabilities." So they realized that whoever controlled space would control the Earth. Whoever controlled space would win all the wars on the Earth below. And so today, all warfare in space is coordinated by military satellites. So no matter whether you're a troop on the ground, in a tank, on a boat, or on a plane, everything is coordinated from space. So if you control space, you control the planet. The Kosovo War, the war with Yugoslavia, was the second space war. The Afghanistan War that's still going on is the third space war. And in fact, in the Afghanistan War, and now today over Iraq, the Pentagon has introduced a new weapon system. You've probably all heard of it, called the Unmanned Aerial Vehicle, the UAV, a pilotless plane that is directed by satellite technology, flies over the battlefield, sending back real-time, split-second time, streaming video to General Tommy Franks, who's sitting at his computer screen in Saudi Arabia. He's looking at the ground, pictures from this Predator, and another one called the Global Hawk. The Predator has been outfitted with weapons. And so as the Predator flies over Iraq, it identifies a target. And General Frank says, "Is it a Russian ambassador? Is it a Syrian bus? Is it the Republican Guard?" And he can push a button and immediately have the Predator fire in real time, hitting the target on the Earth below. It gives the Pentagon the capability to, quote, increase the kill chain. Increase the kill chain. And so this is giving us then real-time intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, and precision targeting capability over Iraq. A couple years ago, the Pentagon released a report saying that the United States must dominate space in times of war. And in order to do that, they said, we must develop the capability to neutralize and destroy other countries' space assets, meaning their satellites in space. Because if we can see the Earth and direct attack, so could someone else. And so we've got to be able to take them out. This is one of the Pentagon's planning documents called Vision for 2020. Here you see a satellite hitting targets on the Earth below. Let's take a look at some of the language in this so-called Vision for 2020. In a section called Future Trends, they say that because of corporate globalization of the world economy, they expect that there's going to be a widening gap between the haves and the have-nots, the rich and the poor around the world. And as a result, there's going to be more and more regional instability around the world as workers who are today under the boot of the multinational corporations are going to try to kick up. They're going to try to organize unions. They're going to try to take their countries back. They're going to protest. And the Pentagon says, you know, we can't put a Marine, try as we may, on every single street corner of the world to suppress these populations, these growing legions of poor people in the future. But with space technology in place, we'll be able to hear everything, see everything, and ultimately target everything on the Earth below. And so the Pentagon says, the Space Command says that space superiority will emerge as an essential element of battlefield success in future warfare. I think this New York Times story from 1999 tells the same thing in a different way. Written by a guy you probably heard of, Thomas Friedman. The headline story was called What the World Needs Now. For globalism to work, America can't be afraid to act like the almighty superpower that it is. Now, last year, I did speaking tours in several countries, and I did a six-city tour in France. A lot of people are into French bashing these days, but I'm not. I've been drinking more French wine lately than ever before, actually. But while I was in France, in every single city that I went to, when I showed them this one, people had a reaction to it. And what they said to me was, you know, during World War II, half of France was occupied by the Nazis for several years. We know what fascism looks like. We can taste it. And your country has gone fascist, and you American people don't even know it. Now imagine, how do you respond to that when a room full of people tell you that? What do you say? It's like when I went to Hiroshima and listened to the Habakasha tell me that we know you dropped the bombs on us not to end the war was over. You dropped them as a test. How do you respond to people when they tell you something like that? Now, getting back to this vision for 2020, here they get right down to it. They talk about how we're going to dominate space and how we're going to control space, and they define it. Control of space is the ability to assure access to space, freedom of operations in the space medium, and most importantly of all, they say, an ability to deny others the use of space. We, 5% of the world's population, are going to deny other countries the use of space. At the Space Command headquarters at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado, on the building they have their slogan that reads, Master of Space. And in fact, they wear that as a patch on their uniform. We are going to be the masters of space. This might be hard to see, but this is from an Air Force website called Weather as a Force Multiplier, Owning the Weather in 2025. The Pentagon today is developing weapons that they can use to change the weather, to use the weather as a battlefield weapon. The idea is, if you can make it rain right before you invade a country or attack a country, you bog them down. They can't get their planes off the ground. Or if you can create a drought condition by changing the weather, you can create such a crisis in an area that they'll have a refugee situation because of the drought. It'll make it easier to go in and invade and take control over a particular part of the world. And so, friends, the scientists and technologists and militarists are out of control. They see themselves literally as God, messing with the creation, if you will. But to understand all of this, I think you have to understand the origins of the U.S. space program. Where did it begin? How did it begin? And to have that understanding, you have to go back to Nazi Germany. The guy with the broken arm is the brilliant young rocket scientist by the name of Wernher von Braun. He was recruited by the man on the left with the hat, Major General Walter Dornberger. Hitler sent Dornberger to ask von Braun, who had a weekend rocket club, and he had a group of friends. They were working on developing rockets, and they asked him to come to work for the Nazis to build the super weapons, the V1 and V2 rockets that Hitler used to terrorize the cities of London and Paris and Brussels with at the end of World War II. And so for von Braun, they created a brand new place called Peenemünde. Up on the Baltic Sea in northern Germany, they made him an SS officer, and they built a whole production and test facility at Peenemünde. And to Peenemünde, the Nazis brought thousands of Jews and French resistance fighters to come and serve as slaves for the operation. Well, the British found out about it, went in and bombed the entire operation. And so the Germans said, we have to move to a more secure location. And so down inside of central Germany, there's a mountain chain called the Harz Mountains. And inside the mountain was a huge tunnel where the Germans were storing military hardware. They cleared it all out. They moved the whole rocket operation inside of there. And they called this place Middlework. And just outside the mountain of Middlework, they created a brand new concentration camp called Dora. And to Dora, the Nazis brought 40,000 Jews, gypsies, French resistance fighters, homosexuals, even a black American GI prisoner of war were brought to this place to serve as the slaves for the Nazis. Well, the slaves began to sabotage the operation. They left screws unturned on the rockets. They urinated on the wires so that when von Braun and his team were launching the rockets, they were going haywire. And so he sent his team in to find out who did this. And they identified 100 of the slaves and summarily hung them inside the mountain in front of everyone as a warning that you will not interfere with the war effort. Well, eventually the Allies even closed in on this place too. And when they arrived, they found some survivors, some emaciated human beings. In fact, one of the first to arrive was an 18-year-old young American GI by the name of Hugh Carey. He later became governor of New York State. But he said when they arrived, what they found was thousands and thousands and thousands of dead bodies lying at their feet, waiting to be shoved into the crematory ovens. The Nazis had fled for the hills. Von Braun and his team had fled for the hills, knowing that if they were apprehended, they would be accused of crimes against humanity. And what the Americans discovered at this place is that 25,000 of the 40,000 slaves at this place perished at the hands of the Nazis. Well, after the war, there was the Nuremberg trials, at which time the Nazis were brought to justice for their crimes against humanity. But 1,500 of the top Nazi scientists never went to trial. They were smuggled into the United States by the U.S. military in a program called Operation Paperclip, smuggled in through Boston and West Palm Beach, Florida. 100 of them were von Braun and his rocket team, along with 100 copies of the V-2 rocket. They were sent first to White Sands in New Mexico, and then on to Huntsville, Alabama, to create the U.S. space program for the United States. But who were the other 1,400 Nazi scientists, and where did they go? They were the ones that were brought to the United States to create the CIA, because they knew the names of the communists. They knew who they were. They had been fighting the communists, and they were brought to create the CIA. Then there was the scientists that were brought to the United States that were put in charge of the MK Ultra program, the mind control experiments, and the LSD drug experiments of the 60s, where people, American citizens, were given drugs. They were jumping out of windows, killing themselves. These were the former Nazi scientists who were brought here to create that program. Nazi scientists in Germany that were taking Jews and putting them in freezing temperatures to see how the bodies reacted to the cold. If a pilot was to be shot down over the Baltic Sea, the Nazis wanted to see how the body reacted to freezing temperatures. These guys were sent to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio to create the Air Force's flight medicine program after World War II. And so the entire military-industrial complex of America was seated with the best and brightest of the Nazi scientists. Wernher von Braun was sent on to Huntsville, Alabama, where he became NASA's first director of the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville. The former flight test director up at Peenemünde, Kurt Diebus, became the first director of the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. The guy that recruited von Braun, Major General Walter Dornberger, became vice president of Bell Aerosystems Corporation in New York that made its riches building the helicopters for the war in Vietnam. And he also was appointed to serve on the first NASA Oversight Committee when NASA was created right after the war. Now, when the military heard that NASA was going to be created, they freaked out. You can't have a civilian space program. The military has to be in charge of space. Don't worry. Don't worry, they were told. From the first day, we're going to have an oversight committee that makes sure that the Pentagon controls the space program. And Major General Walter Dornberger was appointed to that committee. In 1958, testifying before a congressional hearing, Dornberger said that America's top space priority should be to, quote, conquer, occupy, keep, and utilize space between the Earth and the Moon. Later on, in a speech before a national missile industry conference, Dornberger said, "Gentlemen, I didn't come to this country to lose the Third World War. I lost two." And finally, the man that was in charge of production inside the mountain tunnel at Middlework, Arthur Rudolph, the guy that cracked the whip on the slaves to keep them producing the rockets, he became the project director for NASA's Saturn V rocket program that took the United States to the moon. So these are the origins of the U.S. space program. And so today when we hear this slogan at the Space Command headquarters, Masters of Space, I can't help but see an ideological link between that and Deutschland über alles, Germany overall, or Master Race, Master of Space. Now, I know you've all heard of this new program called Missile Defense. The rogue states are going to attack the continental United States. We have to make sure that we can intercept North Korea's missile that does not exist today that can reach the mainland of America, or Iraq's missile that does not exist today that could reach the mainland of America, or Iran's missile that does not exist today that could reach the mainland of our country. They say we've got to be able to have a bullet hit a bullet way up in deep space in order to protect the continental United States. And this program will cost the American people, that Bush now says will be deployed before the next election in 2004, deployed at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, and at Fort Greely in Alaska. As you know, last June, Bush walked away from the ABM Treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty with Russia, that outlawed these kind of technological developments in the arms race. We walked away from the treaty. Bush now says we're going to deploy missile defense. And just a few weeks ago, Bush made the announcement that we do not even have to test the program. We will deploy without testing, he said, knowing that the tests haven't been going so well. And he's now ruled that we can just deploy it without even fully testing it. And of course, we now know too that this program of so-called missile defense will cost the American taxpayer hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. They say initially we want to have up to 100 interceptors protecting the West Coast. Then we want to put 100 more in North Dakota and maybe even 100 more in the state of Maine protecting the East Coast of the United States. And how will they pay for this program? Will they raise taxes? No. Bush is cutting taxes for the rich. We now know that 1% of the American people own as much wealth in America as the bottom 95% of the population. And Bush wants to give even more tax cuts to the top 1%. No, we're not going to raise taxes to pay for Star Wars. We're going to cut education. We're going to cut health care. We're going to cut environmental programs. We're going to break into the Social Security lockbox. That's how we're going to pay for this program. And ultimately, I want to say that this so-called missile defense has absolutely nothing at all to do with defense anyway. It's a Trojan horse. It's not about defending the American people at all. It's about controlling space. It's about dominating space. It's about denying other countries access to space. It's about the United States becoming the master of space. The day before he was sworn in as the Secretary of War by President Bush, Donald Rumsfeld released a report to the nation called the Rumsfeld Space Commission Report. And in that report, this is a page from it, Rumsfeld said that in the coming period, the United States will conduct operations to, from, in, and through space in support of its national interests, both on Earth and in space. And they provided us with this graphic of a new military doctrine called full spectrum dominance. The idea of full spectrum dominance is that the United States must dominate war at every level of conflict. We must dominate the earth with our military on the ground. We must dominate the air above the earth with our air force. And we must dominate the heavens with our weapon systems that are today being developed, many of which are right here in Southern California by Lockheed Martin and Boeing and TRW and Raytheon. But there's a whole nother program besides national missile defense, having a bullet hit a bullet in deep space. There's another program called theater missile defense, TMD. The idea of theater missile defense is you don't wait till the missile gets way up into deep space. You forward deploy your systems. You surround the offending third world country or the offending rogue state so that as soon as they try to launch anything, you hit it immediately as soon as it's launched in what's called its boost phase. And so this theater missile defense or boost phase defense is now moving forward as the preferred deployment option of the Bush administration and the Democrats in Congress. The Democrats in Congress have given Bush every single penny in the first 2 years he's been in office that he's asked for these programs. And the Democrats say we must have theater missile defense or boost phase defense in order to protect our troops and ships around the world. And of course, the question is, what are our troops and ships doing all over the world? And of course, the answer is control and domination for the multinational corporations, something the Democrats agree with the Republicans that we as a nation should be doing. Now, theater missile defense or boost phase defense is based three ways. One is on ships, Aegis destroyers that are now being constructed at Bath Iron Works in the state of Maine, ground-based launchers, and the airborne laser, a converted Boeing 747 with a laser beam on its nose that they say will fly 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, over the offending territory. Each of these different systems giving the United States the capability to immediately hit anything that gets lifted off the ground, all coordinated with the new Star Wars satellites that are being developed today by these big weapons corporations. Now, China today has 20 nuclear missiles capable of hitting the United States. We're the leader of the pack. We have 7,500. Why do we want to surround China with theater missile defense? We'll only provoke them, force them to build more, create a new arms race. It just doesn't make sense, does it? And then I found this article a couple years ago in the Washington Post. The headline reads, "For the Pentagon, Asia moving to the forefront." And the article says that the United States will now manage China. How about that? We're going to manage China. The article goes on to say that we will double our military presence in the Asian Pacific region. We've been lengthening and widening the runways on Guam and Wake Island in the Pacific to handle the B-1 and B-2 bombers. And we've already pre-positioned cruise missiles on Guam. And now we're going to deploy theater missile defense in the Asian Pacific region. Well, let's take a look at the map. This is what we call our unsinkable aircraft carrier, Japan, where today we have 40,000 U.S. troops deployed. And we're going to put theater missile defense in Japan. And right next door in South Korea, We have 40,000 U.S. troops deployed. And in fact, in the last month, Bush has sent even more deployments there of U.S. troops because things have been a bit destabilized there recently. And we're going to put theater missile defense in North Korea. We're going to put theater missile defense in Taiwan and in Australia and on ships and planes, beginning a coastal encirclement of China. And again, how is China going to respond? You remember when Russia and the Soviet Union tried to put nuclear missiles in Cuba, 90 miles off the coast, came into our backyard, our sphere of influence. We almost went to nuclear war over it. But somehow, China is supposed to acquiesce and just turn the other cheek as we do the reverse to them. Well, since 9/11, I look at this map a little differently. I look over here at this region that we now call Central Asia. We now know a little more about it, where today the United States is establishing permanent military bases in Afghanistan and Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan and other places within that region. And we've all heard Bush say that it's going to be a long, long war. The American people had better be patient, right? Well, I think it's common knowledge now, but the day after 9/11, I went to my world atlas because admittedly, I didn't know a great deal about that region. So I looked up these countries. I learned from my experience in the Air Force, after reading the Pentagon Papers, to always ask the next question. Why? What? Who? How? And of course, now today we all know that Central Asia has some of the largest deposits of oil and natural gas in the entire world. How many of you know who a guy by the name of Zbigniew Brzezinski is? Remember, he worked for Jimmy Carter. He was his national security advisor, the same job Condoleezza Rice has today. Well, he wrote a book in 1997 called The Grand Chessboard. And I want to show you two pages from his book. Remember, it was written in 1997. He says that the United States must build oil pipelines through this region of the Middle East and Central Asia so that we will be able to control the flow of oil. He particularly points out that with a pipeline through Afghanistan, it says UNICAL pipeline, that with this pipeline through Afghanistan, it would allow the United States to move oil into the Arabian Sea that we can then take to emerging markets throughout the Asian Pacific region. It's interesting that at that same time in 1997, I saw it on the Congressional Record website, that a UNICAL vice president testified before the Congress of the United States. He pleaded with the Congress to help UNICAL have a more compliant government in Afghanistan that would allow the construction of an oil pipeline through their country. And in the second page from Brzezinski's book, he talks about two key collision points, as he calls them, in this part of the world. He says, in order for the United States to control this part of the world in the coming period, we must control two key collision points. One being the coastal region around China, where today we are now planning to deploy theater missile defense, and the other is the Central Asian region where today we have built bases to control this part of the world. Checkmate. Russia, look at Russia's proximity. Look where China is. Checkmate on the world. If you look at this map again, You look at Iran. Some people say that's the next one we might invade. Look how we now have Iran surrounded with bases in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and throughout this region here with bases in Saudi Arabia. Or some people are saying, next we're going to go after Syria in this endless war that Bush has declared on the world. This is a page from a Space Command planning document called Long Range Plan. It's not just the Middle East or Central Asia that the United States wants to control. It's the entire planet. Their vision is to control the entire planet Earth through space technology. This plane up here is what they call the military space plane that is being developed today and will be sold to us as the successor to the shuttle. You know, we've been having some problems with the shuttle fleet. It's getting a little old and unreliable. We're going to have to upgrade it. And so we're going to build the military space plane that just coincidentally will be used to participate in war in space. And then, of course, the space-based laser is also now under development, and the new Star Wars satellites under development as well. About a year and a half ago, Aviation Week and Space Technology, one of the leading industry magazines, reported on a computer war game that had just taken place at the Space Command headquarters in Colorado. It was set in the year 2016. It was the blue team versus the red team. And in that computer war game, the United States launched a preemptive first strike attack on China. Now, a year and a half ago, people used to kind of snicker at me when I would use those words, preemptive first strike attack. Some people would raise their hand and say, you know, our country would never do that. But now, of course, you all know that that's the official military doctrine of our government today. That's what we've just done with Iraq, preemptive first strike attack. And in this preemptive first strike attack in the year 2016, the United States launched an attack on China, and the first weapon that was used in the war was the successor to the shuttle, the military space plane that flew down from orbit, dropped an attack on China, and then went back up again. And the second weapon that was used in that war game was the space-based laser, firing from space and hitting targets on the Earth below. In 1989, I organized a demonstration at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. One of many that I've organized over the years there. But what made that one particularly important for us was we had an Apollo astronaut come and speak. His name was Edgar Mitchell. He was one of the early moonwalkers, and he came to speak out against space weapons. He said, we can't let the Pentagon put weapons in space. He said, in fact, we can't even let them test weapons in space. He said, because today there is so much space junk orbiting the Earth, space debris, at 18,000 miles an hour, that if we even test weapons in space by, let's say, blowing up an old satellite, we will create so much more space junk that we will not be able to get a rocket off the planet Earth. We'll be entombed to the planet because we won't be able to get through the minefield of space junk. Today there are 110,000 pieces of space junk larger than a half of an inch orbiting the Earth. So many that they track them on the big radar screen at NORAD and Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado. Recently, the International Space Station, originally they said it was going to cost $10 billion. Today the price tag is $100 billion, by the way. They had to move the space station to another orbit because they said space junk was coming dangerously close and they were afraid they were going to collide. Some scientists say they'll never finish construction of the space station because it will be destroyed before it's even finished. Who knows? In this particular graphic from Harper's Magazine, they point to this one little speck here And they say this is one of 34 nuclear reactor cores that will fall back to Earth in the next 1,000 years. Come to find out, since the beginning of the space age, since the early 60s, the United States and the former Soviet Union have launched over 40 nuclear reactors, military satellites, orbiting the Earth, some powered by uranium, some powered by plutonium. And there have already been eight accidents falling back to Earth. The worst was 1964. U.S. military satellite with 2 pounds of plutonium fell back to Earth, burned up on reentry, similar to the Columbia accident recently that we all witnessed. The plutonium turned to dust. It was carried by